we have a poem which is regarded by lots of literary critics who spend great amounts of time pondering these matters to be one of the four or five greatest lyrics in the English language. Whether one agrees with that or not, and whether one sensed as one read it, I certainly did when I first read this poem, that one was in the presence of this kind of quality, isn't so much the point as to simply let you know that unlike The Road Not Taken, this poem seems to be more prominent in the poems that people who study English literature must read. If some of you were at my morning session the other day, I digressed momentarily to talk about Immanuel Kant, who was a philosopher, and indicated that Kant didn't begin writing his great philosophical works until he was 59 years old. And had he died at age 58, we would have thought of him as a sort of an obscure and somewhat cranky Prussian. Keats is the opposite. That is, he died at age 26. Did most of his brilliant work between the ages of 22 and 26, a fact which I find positively astonishing. I think that I will read the poem first today because it's longer and because as I go along, I'm not going to try to do an interpretative reading so much as I'm going to read through it with you and along the way clear up a few typos and gloss a few of the words, that is, tell you what they mean, because you didn't have a chance to do that yourselves before coming to class. And I think it's important that we get the precise meaning of a few of the key terms. To autumn, then. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit. This was a bizarre kind of typo. Brut being a brand of shaving lotion. It's kind of a grotesque typing error, actually. At any rate, change that to fruit. With fruit, the vines that round the thatch eaves run. To bend with apples the mossed cottage trees and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow, sound asleep, drowsed with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes, like a gleaner, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook, or by a cider press, with patient look, thou watchest the last oozings, hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too. While barred clouds, barred simply means striped, alternating clouds and sky and alternating shades of cloud and so on. Streaked would be another synonym. Pardon?
Bars.
Yeah, barred. Right. While barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue, then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly-born, hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft the redbreast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies. All right, sallows are willows. Born, the B-O-U-R-N, born, in the third stanza, fourth line from the last, means boundary or limit or terminal point and horizon. Croft, by the way, whenever you look up these words, when you're reading a poem, it's a good idea to use the OED if you have access to it, Oxford English Dictionary. For example, the dictionary back here lists as a meaning of croft a small field adjoining a house, and it surely does mean that. And that surely seems to be the meaning warranted by the context. But a subordinate or second meaning of croft is also crypt. So you might note that. Or a vault for interring bodies. Okay, any other questions about words that whose meaning puzzled you and we could clear up before we start? Okay, let's begin then. Yesterday, in considering the frost poem, we found it, I think, very productive to try to isolate how many parts the poem had. We noticed that its structure, that is, what accounted for getting from one stanza to another, was narrative, that is, a kind of story. So the poem tended to move through time. Upon closer inspection, we discovered that there was not one, but there were two stories in The Road Not Taken. A long one in the past tense, and a short one that comprised the last three lines of the final stanza. Once we isolated this kind of two stories business and compared stories, that we really began to get deeper and deeper into how the poem worked. I think it's clear enough to see that this poem does not really tell a story as a whole poem, or two stories, or any number of stories. But it still seems to me to be a good place to begin to ask, how would one describe or explain the movement of this poem from the first through the third stanza? If it's not a story, then what is it? Does anybody care to venture a kind of...
It seems to me that the first two stanzas belong together, and then the last one is different.
Okay. So you would say that this poem has two parts, and the break comes between, the major break, between the second and the third stanza. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a little bit of... elaboration of your reasons for that?
Well, because it seems like the first two stanzas are full of autumn, and then it says, where are the songs of spring? And then it kind of brings you back to spring.
Okay. So your claim, you think that the first two stanzas are about autumn and the last one about spring? I think the last is more about autumn also. Could you help us out to see why you think that? You kind of want to withdraw your...
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
It just brings you to spring for a minute, but then it pulls you right back again.
Okay. So we couldn't argue that it has two parts if we want to say that the first two are about autumn and the last about spring. That won't work, but not necessarily to reject the intuition that a major break takes place there. Maybe a different kind of break, but it may still be that the break is there or elsewhere. Or for that matter, that there are three parts and they conform to the three stanzas. Yes, Bill?
It seems to me it's all about autumn, but there's a beginning and kind of ending where in the first part you still feel maturing process that is in going on and more to come, and by the last stanza things have kind of come to the harvest has come, and you're looking at the other side of this, almost a death, looking towards spring again and new budding, or a kind of wistfulness.
Okay, there's another account of the movement of the poem, which suggests that even though it isn't a story necessarily, there is a kind of progress that the different aspects of autumn that are consecutively represented are first something like maturing, second something like harvesting, and third something like tending toward ends. So that the movement is something like a movement through time, in the sense that full maturing precedes harvesting, which then precedes sort of the last lingering moments tending toward winter. Or I guess you said tending toward spring, didn't you?
Well, it's tending towards winter, I think, but a kind of wistfulness looking again to the next cyclical season.
Okay. So here's a hypothesis. The poem has three parts. All the parts are about autumn, and they go this way, maturing, harvesting, tending toward...
toward winter, kind of closure.
Closure. Will that work? People think that that will work.
Yeah. Because in the first one, you're talking about the apples are coming on, and the says the kernels, the later flowers are coming in. But in the next one, you have a half-reaped furrow, and the cider press is in operation. And then in the last one, you're completely harvested, and the swallows are getting ready to eat. So I would agree with that.
Okay, those kinds of details would tend to support the hypothesis. All right, let's write with that hypothesis further and inspect now more carefully each of the three stanzas and see whether or not the details, as we look at them very closely, fall mainly within the three aspects that we're thinking structure the movement of the poem. Yes?
If I were reading this, I would think, now where are the songs of spring? I would think it would be a going back that, like we often do, where is the summer gone? Mm-hmm. And going back to the spring that it has rapidly gone.
So you think the sudden break into the question, interrogative voice, where are the songs of spring, is a backward looking, where have they gone, rather than how soon will they be coming off?
That's the way I would look at it.
Okay.
When just reading it through first.
I think that's fair enough because it's winter entirely.
Okay. But of course, if he's looking forward or backward, he's skipping a season, though. To look backward and ask where the songs of spring, he's skipping summer, and to look the speaker, and to look forward and ask where are the songs of spring, he's skipping winter. Can you indicate a little more about what makes you think, or what makes someone else think? They agree that where are the songs of spring is really looking backward rather than anticipating.
Sure, it goes on to say, think not of them. Thou hast thy picture too, is the best song. The song has the music too.
For sure.
Why do you think that the song is
now? Okay, so you think that in order for fall to remember the songs of spring and think of them, it must have already heard them, which means that it refers to the spring that's already passed or the spring that is to come.
And there does seem a real parallel to the kind of question that you ask of, oh, where has youth gone? Sort of, where are the songs of spring? And it seems that to be such a parallel to youth and age that has started me thinking more in terms of autumn and a relationship between middle age or aging, a life cycle as well as the season cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So that it still seems to be a backward
glance,
yeah.
Okay. So that the last stanza then, which speaks of the song of autumn or the music of autumn, is spoken, what initiates that speaking is the looking backward and asking where has spring gone, or where are the songs of spring? A spring past rather than anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That doesn't necessarily, it seems to me, yet fully undercut or make us want to abandon the scheme we had about maturing, then harvesting, then a kind of closure, though it does complicate the matter. So let's now look specifically together at the first stanza and see whether or not the first stanza, in terms of its details and all the other aspects of it, do roughly suggest maturing rather than endings or harvestings or something.
Yeah, their fruitfulness certainly does.
Okay. Fruitfulness. And this is certainly about a lot of fruits that are full, or that autumn is conspiring with the sun to make full.
It says something about the function of the sun, that it contributes to the maturing process. The maturing sun, that's one way.
How does that work in the first two lines? Season of mist and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun. Now, given that autumn is being personified here, what precisely is autumn being personified as?
Late life.
Pardon?
Late life.
In those two lines, you think it would be late life. What would make you think that?
Well, it's the maturing sun and mellow fruitfulness and those things.
It's a friend, isn't it?
Does autumn have a sex? Let me ask that. Or is autumn kind of neuter? More masculine?
Well, that is a cool one after this happy sun, isn't it?
Yes.
Comparing it to a pregnant woman.
It is autumn.
I started out when I said it. I think to mean the maturing sun would be like the pregnant woman who has the it says with all the fruit ripeness to the core to serve the gourd and plump food. In other words, it's harvest time, but perhaps rather than the maturing sun, perhaps it is autumn. It's more like the mother.
Yes.
I guess I would agree with that image with the fertile earth as a kind of pregnant season, mm-hmm. bringing forth fruit like a season.
Does the speaker here use words later? That is the speaker's diction, his word choice, such in the rest of the stanza to suggest notions like pregnancy and mm-hmm. can you find instances of that?
Swell the gourd.
Swelling.
Hazelnuts.
Plump, yes.
Filled with ripeness.
Filled with ripeness, yes. It seems to me that we have lots of verbs. Swelling, filling, plumping, and so on, which invite that. Are those descriptions of autumn, per se? Plump, filled, and so on. Are we all settled on the notion that autumn is a feminine gender? Whether she's pregnant or not, we can leave it in suspension for a moment. That the sun is masculine, conspiring with him. Him is sun. Pardon?
Yeah, the sun is masculine.
Okay, autumn is feminine. And they conspire together. The word conspire is a very interesting word because it has denotations of work with and connotations of something vaguely sinister or at least sly going on.
Mystery.
Yeah, mystery. Mm-hmm. How to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatched eaves run. All right, now we have bending apples, filling fruit, ripeness, swelling gourds, plumping. We've talked about all those. And they do seem to support notions of a conspiracy or a union for the sake of impregnating or swelling fruit. Fruitfulness, both in the sense of fruitful, that is bearing fruit, and full of fruit, or full fruit. Okay, but now we get to the last part of this. To set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Would anyone care to reflect on this as either another instance of maturing that kind of activity, or impregnating, or something else? What precisely, let me ask this question. Someone said earlier, one of the activities autumn does is to provide a continual number of warm days. Is that what this says?
It almost seems like it's a suspension.
It talks about more, still more, and later flowers, so that you get some progression of time. But until they think warm days will never cease, it's almost like a suspension of time, where you want it to go on forever. You know something about what's ahead, or now I'm probably taking it out of account at the time. But I feel like there's a suspension there.
Hmm. Let me ask this, who's they? Who thinks? There's a couple copies of it. Who's they? Until they think.
The bees.
The bees. Bees. And what exactly is it that the bees think? They think that warm days will never cease. What else do they think? They also think that there's an explanation for that. For summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells, right?
They have given them so many flowers that they collected so much honey.
Yeah. And it keeps coming, because those flowers are, new ones are coming.
Okay. So would it be fair to say on the grounds of this that another activity of autumn is deception? I mean, conspiracy is one. Is deception another?
Yeah, okay.
I mean, in other words, the bees think that warm days will never cease, and not only do they think that warm days will never cease, they blame the wrong season for it. I want to run past people on this. Do people see that it's the bees who reason that summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells, when in fact it's autumn that's done that?
Well, isn't it both summer and autumn?
Yeah, it seems to me the summer is also kind of in this conspiracy, sort of running over.
So you think
it's
that
kind of part of the suspension that she was talking about, I think.
To set budding more and still more later flowers. So you feel like they've started earlier, and the bees got an early start, and it just kind of continues on into autumn.
Mm-hmm.
Has it been an exceptionally long autumn? What we call back home Indian summer? An Indian summer has intervened, and winter hasn't set in.
Is that what you think is kind of implied here in the stanza?
I would interpret it that way.
That there's been an exceptionally long autumn that has this kind of thing like Indian summer? Would you go so far as to suggest that when it says for summer, it's referring to that special kind of summer? The rest of you want to strike a plausible chord in your mind?
Was climbing with sweat.
Would anybody care to? That would certainly be one reading. Clammy.
Sticky.
Sticky. Mm-hmm. How do you like the notion? How do you like that? Summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells.
What are those clammy cells? I don't know what that means.
Honeycomb.
And I wondered. I thought, is that what you think it means?
Well, it seemed to me that it probably means that. I mean. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think so too, but I just wasn't sure.
The cell, meaning, you know, when you pick up a honeycomb, you see all those little...
Mm-hmm.
Right. Cell will mean, if you look it up, any kind of small hollow space, which would certainly suit this. It also has some other meanings. Do people know what other meanings cell might be? In ordinary language, how else do we use the word cell?
Well, like a part of a living...
Okay, a living structure, part of a living structure. And what else? What's the most common use of the word cell, do you suppose?
A separate place.
Oh, like a prison, you mean? Yeah.
Cell block, 105, people are behind bars, trapped, whatever,
mm-hmm.
imprisoned. So there's imprisonment, there's the source of life, and there's, in the immediate context, the bees having their own dwelling places, or brimmed. That is, honey's overflowing. What does this mean, quite literally, is happening? I mean, what happens if the bees are not only deceived and think warm days will never cease, but because there's such an incredible richness and ripeness, in this case, of flowers, they or-brim their cells. What then would happen to the bees? On a just kind of a literal level, if the place where they live became filled with honey. Well, they may have to find another place, or if they stay there, they'd obviously die, right? So the sense of clammy is dank or moist or sickly sweet would very much apply to a cell that's overbrimmed with honey, which would itself... All right, now back to the original hypothesis. Do all these details then support the notion of maturing? Is it a kind of, when you read this stanza, do you get a sense that all of this maturing is presented with a tone of great approval and positive, happy report? Or is there some doubt about it? Or are things simply full grown? Are they ripe? Are they overripe? Is there...
Yeah. Well, it's this terrific gushing or overflowing of the time, it seems to me, and it's not until the last several lines that you have a sense that this overflowing is misleading, that it's this terrific gush, that it's such a weighty verse as far as its imagery and words. And then at the very end he starts talking about how deceptive that is.
Okay.
Which has several lines?
Of that first one.
Okay. Until they think warm days will never cease for some of it.
Okay, so the kinds of undertones of doubt or a kind of sinister quality to the ripeness, certainly nice that everything is ripening, but in the word conspiracy and in the notion of deception, there's a kind of other side to this that's introduced that may have troublesome qualities to it. And o'erbrimmed, that's not just brim, but o'erbrim. And the whole phrase, to set budding more and still more later, I mean, in other words, more and more and more and more and more. It seems as though growth without end, a kind of heaviness.
Yeah.
Women here who have born children know better than I ever could what it feels to be overly pregnant, to be overdue. This is not an altogether happy time. It's nice to be ready to give birth, but it's the overripeness and so on has connotations in your own experience, I'm sure, that that Keats is trying to capture here in words, by the more and more and later flowers and the deception and the conspiracy and all of that. I think we're right about maturing as a word that perhaps captures the sense, but there's a sense of over-maturing, excess, clammy cells. It's not a phrase that we're very happy with, I don't think, as being unequivocally ebullient, joyous. Notice, let me just call this to your attention, that insofar as the first stanza is concerned, it has a period after it, which indicates the end of a sentence. But the whole first stanza is not a sentence. As a matter of fact, it's a sentence fragment. As a matter of fact, it's a huge thing, a huge syntactical unit, which never closes, though it longs to close, and looks like it's closed because it's got a period there. Let me just read it and indicate by the punctuation that there's an address to autumn, season of mist and mellow fruitfulness, but then all of the rest of that is a kind of a appositional phrase describing autumn. Okay, let me show you how that works by reading it that way. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatched eaves runs, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd, and plump the hazel shells with the sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells.
That's what might be why you've got such a feeling of suspension there, too.
Right. Exactly. There's a certain syntax that enacts this kind of stasis, which you caught at the end, and this kind of overabundance of words and description, which yet don't close. I mean, a kind of over-ripeness of language and over-richness and abundance, but that longs for closure, but doesn't. This poem couldn't possibly end. If you read it, you'd know, I think, it's an experiment I've always wanted to try and haven't, to just hand out the first stanza and say, here's the poem to autumn, and see who'd first say, well, you know, this poem really can't end here. You feel it can't end, though it wants to, but it's so rich. All right, well then, suddenly a new tone is introduced in terms of a question being asked. Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? And this, the notion was that we had harvest imagery here. We in fact have a series of personifications. We'll just call attention to them, and as I do that, think about what the relationship among them might be. Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind. Or, on a half-reaped furrow, sound asleep, drowsed with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And, sometimes like a gleaner, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook. Or, by a cider press, with patient look, thou watchest the last oozings, hours by hours. All right, given that we're trying to characterize autumn through a series of personifications, how does that character develop? What's this character like? Person who gathers after the grain is cut down, gathers it up and carries it off in bales. Ruth and her mother used to glean in fields after the main gleaners had gone through. They gathered up what was left behind. Well, once a gleaner has finished gleaning, there's a large bundle of straw to carry, which one would put over the shoulder, and the head would be heavy laden then, burdened over, and stooped over with the stuff that has been gleaned. Okay, so what kind of, what are the typical kinds of things which characterize autumn in terms of activities? And the nature of those activities, or in terms of locations, or whatever. is autumn harvesting? That was the original conception. Is autumn here personified as harvesting? Where do you think?
Well, the part about the half-reaped furrow, and it talks about by hook. Is this like the Grim Reaper here?
Or a pruning hook, a scythe or a pruning hook. But let's look at that detail now. Is it the case that in that picture that she has drawn our attention to, autumn is personified as harvesting?
Except it doesn't. It says it spares the next swath.
Mm-hmm. What, in fact, is the activity autumn is recorded as engaging in that particular detail?
Sleeping,
right. So in that case, there's inactivity.
Yeah, actually, there's more inactivity than activity here. Autumn is sitting careless on a granary floor, sound asleep, or on the furrow, or drowsy, or by a cider press with a patient look, watching. So it's not an active. Very active.
Rest of you buy that we basically have here a passive rather than an active autumn? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't the gleaner imply that the main harvest is over?
It says a half-reaped furrow. So they have reaped some.
Right, some has been reaped, all right. And as in your, you're pointing, I think, to the passage. Again, steady thy laden head across a brook, right? So clearly something has been gleaned, but is the gleaning actually that activity reported as something that autumn has done in this text? I mean, autumn is steadying the head here, right? Steadying, sleeping, sitting, and watching. Yeah.
It's almost, again, related to the suspension of the last few lines of the earlier one, where there's plenty of time. It's a deception. Autumn is deceived, taking some time out.
Yeah.
I think it's a nice one. Resting.
You like it.
Like it.
Okay, but that's an important, that noticing that is an important, if not a crucial modification in our initial hypothesis, which was that somehow this went from maturing in the first to harvesting in the second. Instead of a kind of an aggressive autumn as actively harvesting, cutting down these heavy laden trees and so on, one has, if not a passive autumn, then a spectating autumn, watching, so on, actually sleeping, if anything, inactivity. If harvesting is activity, autumn is personified here as engaging in, if not passive things, then at least spectating a non-aggressive kind of
autumn. Yeah, it just gets worse and worse.
Okay, so you think
starting,
could you develop that?
Well, okay, starting from this really this overflowing kind of gushiness, that's this weightiness, that's kind of deceptive, then it goes on to being kind of lazy and leaving a furrow half reaped, and it's all pretty careless, and it's got this tremendous store of goods that it's just kind of letting sit there. It just gets more. It just, the kind of sinister quality just gets more and builds. From the first stanza into the second stanza, the last oozing hours by hours is just, it's like the same kind of punch that clammy cells has, is oozing hours by hours, has that same kind of.
So you think there's a kind of uneasiness created here in terms of, you use the word sinister.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's as serious as sinister, but definitely an uneasiness.
It's like almost like it's waiting for something.
Well, it's interesting that the drowsiness is caused because of the human bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's saying.
Right. And how's that interesting, I mean, in terms of...
I don't know, but there must have been poppies there.
Right, a poppy being a source of a kind of drug.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people, whether you want to use the word sinister or uneasiness or strangeness or what not, find that our original notion, which we had gone with, that was put forward by Billy, about maturing, harvesting, closure, as accounting for the movement of the poem, and the three stanzas, has now been complicated, if not modified to the point of we can't quite recognize it, in that maturing in the first stanza has a sense of overripeness, both in the sense that it's not a sentence, though it looks like one with the period. And there is this, and there is the sense of the bees having been deceived. They think one thing, another. The whole kind of sense of stasis, which you pointed out and which others have noticed then in the second stanza. And then where we would expect to find, if we've got this tremendous pressure of overripeness and need for the deception to end, warm days never ceasing, cells being overbrimmed, instead of in the second stanza getting all of this cut down by autumn as the agent, the harvester, the grim reaper. If anything, autumn is, some of you have suggested, reluctant to do it. Some of you have suggested relaxing because anticipating something else. But there is some kind of problem of that nature.
Yeah, the word, when you said drug, all of a sudden that really fit as that whole second stanza as having that quality of being drugged, that real slow.
Mm-hmm. And the sleeping.
But somehow drugged is a little bit, got a little more of an edge to it than just resting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Almost a slow motion.
Mm.
Not fully aware. Distortion.
Okay, without fully clarifying all these, we'll return to some of these issues and try to get clearer on them. Let's move on to the third stanza, because now we break in again, as we did at the beginning of the second, with a question. Where are the songs of spring? Now this kind of pops up rather suddenly. What on earth could have provoked or prompted the speaker, who appears to be asking the question, to ask that question just at that point?
Spring is not an easy time, but you don't, it's lively. And here we are, we just finished this section about being sort of drugged. And it's a contrast to what spring is like.
Okay, because autumn is, the speaker is struck at this point with a contrast, the contrast being where the songs of spring, liveliness, because he's just been confronting its opposite. Just been meditating on its opposite. The opposite of liveliness would be what? You, how did you put it? Drugged, the whole drugged and drowsy and sleepy business?
Well, if you're going to build a comparison with life, you could have this being age looking back on youth. Where is it gone?
Okay. Age looking back on youth, where is it gone? It's interesting to figure out whether the speaker here is asking the question or whether the speaker is speaking for autumn suddenly, which is what you suggested in a way, that the speaker somehow is speaking for autumn, that it's autumn who's really asking the question, where are the songs of spring, and the speaker who's then saying, where are they? It's an interesting question. Punctuation-wise, we don't suddenly have quotation marks. Where are the songs of spring, as though someone else has broken into voice here. And then non-quotation marks, where are they, as though autumn the speaker. But the speaker has gotten, if it is the speaker who says, where are the songs of spring, that person has gotten very close into the consciousness of the persona that he's just described in the preceding stanza, it seems. This kind of strange persona that, instead of harvesting, is seeming to avoid it, or just watch it, or sleep through it, or refrain from it, or something like that. So there's clearly a connection between this restraint, this sleeping, this passivity, this spectating autumn, and the sudden question, where are the songs of spring? How to fully work out that relationship, I don't think we can fully know until we examine exactly what the kind of consolation is following, think not of them, thou hast thy music too. It seems to me we really have to listen to what autumn's music is. So once we do that, we can backtrack through lots of these questions. So tell me about autumn's music.
The gnats are singing wailfully. And the wind is going through the willow trees, and lambs are bleating, the crickets are singing. There's birds and...
Okay, that calls attention to the singers, gnats, birds, lambs. What's the music like? Happy? Sad? Increasingly soft? Increasingly loud? Loud then soft? So you think that where are the songs of spring? Well, they're gone. They would have been happy. Autumn's song is sad. You think that's what the stanza is saying. The song that autumn has to sing. The song of fall is a sad song.
I don't think so.
You don't think so? What makes you think that it's...
I don't know what the poem is, but I certainly don't think...
Well, it says a wailful choir and mourn. Those are sound.
But then at the end you get singing and whistling and twittering.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the speaker is saying, think not of the songs of spring, you have your own. And it doesn't seem like he would say that.
If what?
If it was... sad or a depressing song.
But yet there are different kinds of music.
Yes.
You know, there's joyful music and that's very fast, and there's slower music that's a little bit softer and more, I don't know if it's more comforting, but it's not the arresting, you don't have the arresting feeling that you might have with something faster.
Okay, those are preliminary notions, that it's a sad song and that it's sung by various kinds of creatures that were mentioned. And now let's look at detail by detail, okay? Among the creatures that were mentioned came, let's see, full-grown lambs. Does anybody find anything curious about the phrase full-grown lambs?
Yes, aren't full-grown.
Lambs aren't full grown. Could there be such a thing? What would it be like to be a full grown lamb? Exactly. What does that mean? Lamb does connote, as you point out, a young sheep. That's what lamb means. Youth. But yet it's full grown. But it's not a sheep. Right?
Not even. Still must maintain
sheep.
Some youthful quality.
Okay, it's a union of youth and full grown, full mature.
Maybe it's
transition. Transition.
Well, that seems to me that it means a stopping period.
Because if it's reached its full growth, then it's not going to go any further. It's going to end. That growth is going to end. So that means that the end of the lamb.
It's the end of the lamb, but would that mean it's the end of the animal or the beginning of the sheep? I mean, I don't want to sound silly, but it seems as though either the middle age business, which you pointed out, it's a full-grown lamb, it's not yet a sheep, or the union of the lamb being the young and the full-grown being yet far along in youth, okay? Let's find some other singers and see if we have some.
Again, it's a kind of suspension there.
What about... Let's follow. And full-grown lambs loud bleat. from Hilly Bourne. Locations of where these songs take place are important, and I glossed the word Bourne for you as meaning border, limit, end, terminus. Okay? Now, I mention that again because the next word in the poem is hedge crickets that sing. So after the word Bourne meaning limit, boundary, hedge cricket. A hedge cricket singing. Why do you suppose a hedge cricket?
Hedge is a kind of a boundary.
Right, a hedge is a kind of a boundary or limit or a division point between one field and another, one place and another. What else does the word hedge mean? Anybody ever use the word hedge? Okay, hedging, right. Hedging in language means to make a statement and then make a kind of careful qualification to take it back. Well, I'm hedging my song here, or statement. And hedge also means as in hedge our bets. Like I'll bet on this horse and also this horse, and I really can't lose then. I've got money on both of them. Okay? So there's a kind of duplicitous nature in hedging, and so far as speech, duplicitous, I mean both sides. Speech and, in this case, of course, they're singing, and they're hedge crickets. So that the hedge feeds right into the notion of boundary, limit, division between two things from Bourne, and also the notion of equivocation. So that's a singer that equivocates. The other singer is somewhere between youth and old age. Now, what about the next singer, the Redbreast? What's interesting about the fact that one of the people in the chorus of the Song of Autumn is a Redbreast?
Well, that's more a spring bird.
Fine. The Redbreast is the bird of spring, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's much doubt about that. So the penultimate singer here is the bird of spring, singing in or whistling from a garden croft. And what did I indicate were the two meanings of croft? On the one hand, crypt, a burial place. On the other hand, a field adjoining house where things grow. In this case, things in a garden. So you have the same word here, meaning death, a place where things are buried, and a source of life. Okay? So the locations, Hilly Bourne, garden croft, the singers, hedge cricket, a full-grown but a lamb, a redbreast, bird of spring, whistling, all have notions of that are tricky. That is, that can't either be clearly mourn death-like images or pure beginning or life images, but either somewhere in between, as someone suggested, of a middle thing, or a kind of containing a kind of tension between the young and the old, the life and the death, whatnot, as in the word croft, that location, right? Okay, let's look at some more aspects and see whether hedging, as in hedge cricket, as singer, follows through. I'll just read the passage, and you see if you find more of these kind of balancing one off against another. Thou hast thy music too. Here it comes. While barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue, then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. Okay?
There's an ambivalence there too. It's a wind. Kind of unpredictable.
The clouds are blooming and the day is dying.
Okay. You bloom something that's dying. Bloom the soft dying day. Okay? The clouds borrowed, streaked, as we say, lives or dies, etc., etc. So you see that the music of autumn here, as described, has got this internal tension or internal life in death, death in life kind of quality to it.